Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. The conversations will be archived here for the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy.
Hello, we are with Margaret Levy, and as usual, we allow you to introduce yourself as you'd like to be introduced.
So I'm Margaret Levy, as you said, and I'm a professor of political science at Stanford, formerly director of the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences, CASBIS, where Christian was a fellow not that many years ago.
Thank you for saying that. It feels like quite a while ago, but thank you. So, Margaret, we address a bunch of things on Raiders of the Lost Archive, and it's really an opportunity to kind of explore different types of archival work that people engage in. And we love to interact with folks like yourself because you've done archiving broadly conceived in such a wide variety of different venues. I am, of course, especially in the current context, I'm really interested in the police stuff. You might be over it, might not want to go there, but really, I was always curious, kind of like, what was the guiding question you were interested in when you kind of like moved to that topic as it related to kind of going into the field to collect information, to collect data?
So what got me involved in that, and that was my dissertation, was what became the book Bureaucratic Insurgency, which is about police unions and the development of police unions. And I have to say there were two different things that got me started in that. One was my interest in labor and particularly in urban settings. And so I became quite interested in municipal unions generally. And then when I was beaten up by police in a demonstration in the early 70s against the war in Vietnam, at the end of the day, there was a police riot and I happened to get caught in it and got a black eye from it and was involved in a number of things that followed up from that. I began to think hard about the police and decided that they were a very unlikely group. And the history of police is often as strike breakers, as well as head breakers during demonstrations. And so I was very curious about their impetus, what was getting them to unionize, and how they were interacting with the rest of the labor movement among municipal unions, and what the implications were for cities, for the people that the police were policing, et cetera. And so in order to do that, I engaged in very extensive field work in three cities, Detroit, Atlanta, and New York, which meant walking beats with cops, being in cars with cops, even though that was illegal, going to bars with cops and having discussions with them. They were often testing me. You know, here was this white liberal woman, young woman from Harvard. They could only think the worst of what I was up to in terms of exploring them and looking for material that traced their history and how they came. I did lots of interviews that then were archived and had some surprising moments. There's, for example, there was a group of women police officers who organized in New York, and I was having a little trouble finding them. I hadn't tried real hard yet, but I, you know, had begun on that journey. And I'm literally sitting on a beach in Puerto Rico. I think the only time I've ever been to Puerto Rico. And this woman is sitting next to me and we start having a conversation. I ask her what she does. She's the head of the Women's Police Union of New York. So I I interviewed her on the spot, as it were. So, you know, there were those kinds of lucky circumstances that happened, as well as the hard work that is involved in trying to track people down and get histories from people whose memories are often not great, particularly if you're talking about historic events, whose memories are self-serving, and how to sort that out, or whose memories are flawed. So I discovered a technique, or developed a technique, which I think others use as well. I'm not sure I discovered it. I discovered it for myself, which John Alquist and I used years later in interviewing old-timers in the unions, in the longshore workers' unions in Australia and the U.S., where we'd bring a group of workers together. So instead of just doing an individual interview, particularly when there was historical material involved, we had them all tell what they remembered of the event. They started correcting each other, and the memory started changing. And we'd get some semblance of what actually happened as a result of that. From, you know, again, it wasn't going to be perfect, but it was a little closer than whatever the account was that an individual was selectively remembering as they were fixing each other's stories. And it would often lead them to then remember things they would never have remembered if they weren't interacting. So that turned out to be quite effective. So we often engaged in group interviews in that case rather than the individual interviews I've been doing originally.
What were people telling you about doing ride-alongs with police officers when you were a Harvard graduate student and you were beginning this? Who was advising you and what kind of help did you get?
Well, I had originally started the research thinking that I would be working with someone named Edward Banfield, who I'm sure Christian knows who that is, A Moral Basis of Backward Society and The Unheavenly City and The Unheavenly City Revisited. And he and someone else who was at Harvard at the time, James Q. Wilson, who became my advisor, who's famous, James Q. Wilson's famous for Broken Windows and
bureaucracy,
for all kinds of work on organization and on government. They were doing urban politics at the time, so that's who I stumbled into their seminar. I was really working closely as well with people at MIT, with Michael Lipsky, who wrote Towards a Theory of Street-Level Bureaucrats, and who I did some writing with early on. I can tell you those stories in a separate way. And with a man named Robert Fogel's son, not Bob Fogel, the famous economic historian, but Robert Fogel's son, who's was actually writing a history of police unions, and he was at MIT. So I would say that I had a mixture of advisors. Banfield left to go to the University of Pennsylvania, then came back after I had left Harvard. So James Q. Wilson was my literal thesis advisor. The other person who was on my committee was, I've just blocked his last name, and he's a friend, and I can see him in my mind's eye, Marty, he went to Cornell from Harvard. Anyway, terrific guy, sort of an urban political economic historian. But I was working just as closely with Michael Lipsky and Bob Fogel over at MIT as I was with my so-called Harvard advisors. But Wilson was very supportive. He had done some work with police and thought about it. And he wanted it to be a comparative project, which in the urban politics meant that you looked at more than one city. You just didn't do a case study of one city. And so part of the process was selecting cities that one would give me something interestingly different about them and the mechanics of the police unionization, but also were within my realm of modest resources and being able to afford to go live. So it often meant, who could I find who I could stay with? What cities had someone I could stay with that I could then do the research? But I wanted to do something in the Midwest, something in the Northeast, and something in the South. And so that helped define it as well. So I came up with Detroit, New York, and Atlanta. And it turns out they were really good choices to do.
Did you have different strategies of entree in the three different areas? Or did you face different difficulties getting inside the three different cities?
Yes and no. I would say that in all three, God, it's so long ago now. You know, it's well over 50 years that I was doing this research. So remembering the entree to those cities is a little hard, but I don't, you know, I went and bought clothes that made me look more respectable. I mean, so I worried about entree, but it turns out it wasn't that hard. There weren't that many people studying police unions. And so I was able to pretty much get access fairly early on. And it was just exercising some care not to be imposing some political view or some thesis on them before I even had one, but also letting them guide the research to some extent. I mean, it was really in many ways an historical project. So the boundaries were really, I wanted to know how they got started, how they overcame collective action problems, how they got legal bargaining rights, how they were transformed. And that often happened before in some of these cases. I mean, New York, that really started well before the crucial period of the 1960s when there began to be laws that enabled police to organize and engage collective bargaining. So I was interested in sort of the prehistory and then how these laws got passed. And that meant talking to people like former mayors, Kavanaugh, and in Detroit, and Lindsay in New York, and Wagner in New York, Wagner Jr. Robert Wagner Sr. was involved in other projects I was doing, but he was long gone. In Atlanta, I can't even remember which mayors I talked to, but there were several mayors, some black, some white.
Where is this archive, by the way, if I may interject for that quick one? You said that all this material was archived somewhere. Where is that?
Most of it now is in a little archive that's the Levy Archive at the University of Washington.
Okay.
So any tapes I have from that and any transcripts I did are all there. I saved it all. But, you know, some of the material that it's saved on isn't, like, I worry about the cassette tapes. I don't know what's happening with them. I mean, this was pre-computer. I ended up writing my dissertation on a typewriter. Right?
Hopefully that's in the archive as well.
I have that. But, I have the, probably okay. Here or in my house.
I was going to take the same kind of entree question, but pushing it forward to the Longshore and Warehouse Union piece that you did with John. I'm like, first off, kind of like, what's the fascination with unions? Kind of like, where did that come from? But do you remember your entree for kind of like working with those unions? Was it at all similar really different. Or different from the kind of piece?
That was also experiential in a sense. So I've been interested in unions forever. But they weren't necessarily what defined my work, except for my dissertation and then the last major monograph I wrote, which was the book with John Alquist called In the Interest of Others. Because of the work on police unions, I was a candidate and then was chosen as the Harry Bridges Chair for Labor Studies, the third one to exist at the University of Washington, and therefore the director of the Center for Labor Studies there. So in between, I'd, of course, written books about other men in uniform, namely rulers, and then the book on conscription and consent, dissent, and patriotism, which also has a lot of archival material in it. Both I drew on archives and created archives for both of them. But the union stuff made me the Harry Bridges chair, right? Which I found to be an incredibly interesting experience. And the Harry Bridges chair was largely the product of the Longshore Union of the West Coast of the U.S. So I got to know the longshore workers, literally some of the longshore workers and what they were up to, and was fascinated by their politics and by their processes and their commitments and willingness to engage in all kinds of actions that didn't make sense from a narrow, self-interested point of view, like closing the docks when asked by the local Chinese community because the Japanese had invaded Manchuria and put down the Chinese peasants and workers. And the longshore in the U.S. on the West Coast decided to not ship scrap iron to pig iron to Japan as a protest. And why were they engaging in these actions? And they continued to. That one was in 1937 or 38, but why did they continue to do that up until the time I was the Bridges chair and beyond? And I was Bridges chair in the 90s, like 92 to 96, 96 to 2000. It was founded in 92 when I was the chair. So I got very interested in this union and how they were making decisions and how their processes, what was it about their governance arrangements that could produce these kinds of outcomes or their ideologies or what was it that was happening? And so I began a little research project on it, and John Alquist, who I had just met, he actually had to make a decision whether to go to the University of Maryland and work with somebody called Christian Davenport, who I said was a great guy, but he should instead work with me. So I grabbed him, Christian, sorry, but I did well out of that.
And now he works with me. So now I do well with that.
Yeah, there you go. Right. He's fabulous. So he became my RA the summer before he actually started graduate school and was in on this project I was thinking about and trying to collect information about the way in which the union actually governed itself, because it has this very participatory democracy. And so we began that project, and he was managing a group of undergraduate research assistants for me. And then we realized there was this really interesting question about these costly political actions that they engaged in. And we began to research that and got NSF grants and other kinds of grants to support that research. And he was still my RA, but at some point, not long after we got the money, I realized he was not my RA. He was my co-author. So he was still a graduate student working on his own dissertation at the time that we basically started this process. And then went off to his first, second, now third job. And we finished the book sometime in there. It was published in 2013, but it really had its start sometime between 96 and 2000, whenever he started as a graduate student.
I have a good bit of experience interviewing police officers, militia members, people in uniform, people adjacent to people in uniform. But I have never actually worked extensively with police in the United States. I know them as my neighbors, but not as my research subjects in the United States. So I'm really curious what troubles and opportunities you encountered when you were doing this kind of research 50 years ago. With no more priming than that.
So I'll tell you a story of one of the kinds of experiences. I'll tell you a couple stories. So I'll start with Atlanta. I mean, the most interesting stories probably were Detroit, actually, which is an amazingly interesting, weird place, especially in the time when I was doing these interviews, which was not long, really, in historical time after the Detroit riots. But let me start with Atlanta and New York, because they're a little easier. So the first thing that would happen, you were talking about access, is often I would be assigned what was called an officer friendly, walking the beat with somebody who was supposed to be a liaison with the neighborhood, in a way, to show the friendly side of policing in the aftermath of the rebellions of the 60s. And in New York, that was an old white Irish guy. In Atlanta, it was a youngish black guy, right? But so I'd walk the beats with these guys, and we'd walk and talk. I'd have my little cassette recorder and be recording as we walked and talked, which led to very bizarre transcripts and recordings sometimes. But from that, I would then get the friend, you know, I'd get the trust of the officer friendly, whoever it be, and of some of the people in the department who would then help me you know, reach the union people who might have otherwise been somewhat less trusting of me and what I was up to. And so you just sort of wedged your way up through the system. I also, so that was my first direct interaction with the police themselves, you know, is literally walking a beat with them in those two cities. In Detroit, I did that as well, but I also was interested in meeting some of the police, the black police officers. And I was introduced to this group of black police officers because they were still very much the minority in New York. I mean, in Newark at that time. That has subsequently changed, I think. But that was the case in the late 60s, very early 70s when I was doing this research, 71 or so. So really a long time ago. I was introduced to these guys who were part of one of those terrible squads. What was it called?
In Detroit.
So what?
Stress?
No, Stress? It had another name before that. But they were
the Big Four?
I'm having trouble hearing you, Christian.
I said the Big
no,
Four.
No, it was it'll come to me. But they were the guys who were sort of sent in when something really horrible was happening, and they were very strategic and highly armed and whatever. And these four that I was meeting had actually been involved in a shootout with some of the county police around Detroit, Wayne County police, and they had won. The Detroit police had won. And what I could figure out was it had probably been both of them being engaged in corruption, and it was a fight over spoils. But these were very highly armed, highly trained men, and very scary, I have to say. And they wanted to meet in a bar. So we met in a bar. So that was the first test, right? We met in a bar. And it was the middle of the afternoon. It was well before 5 o'clock. And they wanted to see if I'd drink with them. So I drank with them. My father had taught me how to drink. I knew how to drink. I could probably, I don't know, because I didn't let it go that far, could drink them under the table. But I proved to them I could drink and hold it and be in a conversation with them. So they couldn't hold it as well. So they said, let's get in the car and go find somebody and show you how we operate. And I said, I don't think that's a good idea. I think that violates all kinds of things that I should be doing in terms of an interview. You know, I said, I'm very interested in watching you work, but I'm not interested in going out in the car and finding somebody to see how you operate. And they said, okay, we're just going to go out and drive around the neighborhoods. Like I said, okay. I mean, I had no choice. There were these four big guys. They basically picked me up and put me in the car. So they drove around till they found a pimp who they thought had violated some law or another. It was very easy to violate the laws, right? So they get out and sort of push him around and stuff. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I don't really want to be here. And am I going to live through this, right? So they get back in the car very proud of themselves for having shown off their toxic masculinity to me, words I didn't even know at the time. And then the one of them who's the leader, who really is the leader of the four, and he's clearly like at least 25 IQ points above the other three. He turns to me and he said, you're radical, aren't you? You're a political radical. You must be. You go to Harvard and you're a woman. Why wouldn't you be? And I said, well, yeah, I'm on the left. And he said, so what kind of demonstrations have you been in? And I said, well, I guess one of the most recent ones, I was trying to think of one that wouldn't be too offensive to him, I said, was the Poor People's March in Washington that Martin Luther King had organized before he died. And he said, I was there too. You're okay. So it was that kind of like, who are these people? You know, on the one hand, they're beating up poor people of their own color. And on the other hand, he's appearing at the Poor People's March. So then they decided I was okay, and they dropped me off without further ado back at the police headquarters with promises that I never tell anybody that I drove them around in the car. Of course, I hadn't signed anything, so I was going to reveal that they had driven me around in the car, not to their superiors right then, but I was going to reveal it in my write-ups of my research. So there's experiences with the police. The other experience with the Detroit police was not with a police officer, but with a union organizer, whose name was Jimmy Hoffa. So Jimmy Hoffa had basically organized the police of Detroit. How did he do that? He didn't literally organize them. He threatened to organize them. So the police, the Fraternal Order of Police organization, comes to Jimmy Hoffa and says, we're having trouble organizing. Can you give us some advice? And he said, well, the first thing is, why don't you become part of the Teamsters? And they said, no, we don't want to do that. We want to be independent. He said, okay, but what you need is collective bargaining rights, right? And they said, yes. He said, I'll solve that for you. Give me a couple of days. And he went in to see the mayor and the chief of police. And he said, if you don't give them bargaining rights, I'm going to organize them. And you're going to have to deal with the Teamsters and not a group of guys who don't know how to do this yet. I know how to do this. Do you want to be fighting with me and bargaining with me? Or do you want to bargain with them? And the next day they got bargaining rights as soon as it was legally possible. So I interviewed Jimmy Hoffa and got that story. And I'm having trouble finding my notes for that. I know I filed them somewhere and I can't figure out where I filed them. They may be in my archives at the University of Washington.
Margaret, okay, this is incredible. Okay, so you got me on the, oh yeah, I was in the field shortly after the Detroit riot. You had me there, and then thinking about the turbulent period of like, oh, that's probably a really great time to be talking to the America's police on the heels of this backlash, or in the midst of the wave of police kind of taking everybody out or eliminating many challenges and responding to different types of challenges. So the idea of you going into the field in that environment is very, I'm curious what that environment is like. I'm curious if the people that you were in contact with were just like, you shouldn't probably do this right now or ever. I'm just like, what? I'm just trying to imagine stepping into research into the mid 60s and 70s regarding the police. I'm like, if anybody should have been even, I'm surprised that anyone talked to you. So I'm just like, it's just a complete misread of trying to what the environment must have been like. But is it as bad and formidable as I'm imagining it, to revive
their reputations. This was, you know, the period of a bunch of the liberal mayors that became quite important in trying to. So it wasn't as scary as you think it was. It was scary at times, for sure. And James Q. Wilson still talks about me. Well, he did before he died. Talked about me as one of his gutsiest graduate students ever for taking on this research. But I think that's in part because he never really went into the field in the same way. So might not have even known what was involved, that it wasn't as scary as it seemed. A lot of who I was dealing with were in people in their offices describing their roles as, you know, the president of a union or recounting the history of getting bargaining rights. So a lot of it was not really dealing with the complex sort of social interactions, or it was learning about them, but not being in them. The people who thought I was crazy were actually my friends who were studying the kinds of things that I ultimately did work on, who thought I should be taking on bigger projects. They couldn't understand why police unions were interesting. They were interested in big comparative historical projects. And as you know, Christian, I've always been a believer that in order to speak to some of those things, you have to have a concrete problem that you're looking at. You can't just, so thinking about police unions in three different cities and the ways in which they organized and the kinds of structures that they came up against and the kinds of power relations that existed and the kinds of internal relationships within the departments among different levels of police, you know, sergeants and platoon and basic patrolmen and et cetera, the interracial divides within the police and how those work themselves out. You know, I found all of that incredibly interesting and speaking to the big questions about that Tilly was raising about organization and about social movements and about social action. So I could relate it to that in a way. And it was a way for me to get a grasp of some of those issues at a level that I thought was more, I mean, I always go to the tangible. I mean, look at it in the interest of others. We're looking at details of governance structures as a way to understand how you would build a participatory democracy that might evoke a norm and enforce a norm of acting in the interest of others, of very distant others who can't reciprocate. So I believe in all those, you know, I'm a deep institutionalist. You have to understand all those steps along the process and all those mechanisms to understand the bigger thing that you want to understand. So I don't think it, you know, but I got a lot of pushback from people, my friends at the time, about why I was focusing on this and not some grand historical problem like Theda Scotchpole was looking at. And that just wasn't the way I went about my work. It never has been. I've always done concrete case studies that sort of reveal something bigger.
Yeah, I find it really interesting when you mention the time period. I'm thinking of the rebelliousness of the period and the police kind of response. But then you mentioned Kavanaugh, who's like, you know, the shiny presidential to be, kind of like, you know, pre-Kennedy, well, kind of like, you know, shining light. Yeah, and it's just like they were very powerful. But then you mentioned Hoffa, and I'm just like, and then put it back into the different historical context, which for me was fascinating.
So I have a follow up question on that. Your statement that you work on very small, super grounded questions. What was the small grounded micro foundation that got you into the work on consent, dissent, and patriotism? Because this is a different stage in your life. And it's after Rule and Revenue, but it was my entree into your work because I was very interested in soldiers and political legitimacy and where militaries come from. And at that stage in your life, you weren't doing ride-alongs. You were looking for something that was measurable, as far as I could understand, you know, from your own intro to the book, you know, that it's hard to study tax dodgers. It's pretty easy to study self-maimings. But I doubt that that's actually how you got into the project. And I'd love to know a little bit.
It is actually how I got into the project.
That was it.
So really. I really was looking for some way to, you know, the big finding of Rule and Revenue was quasi-voluntary compliance.
Totally. Yeah.
And I couldn't, and you know, that in order to build a revenue extraction system, it wasn't just a question of economic transaction costs. There were also political transaction costs. And if you couldn't get people to basically go along with what the government was trying to do, even if it was an autocracy, theocracy, that you were going to have to, the kind of enforcement that would have to be developed and the structure of that enforcement to extract taxes and other things would be humongous. And very few states were going to be doing that. So you wanted some sense of legitimacy, some way of creating quasi-voluntary compliance. Yes, there's a state that's backing it up, this rule that you have to give up some of your property and money, et cetera, to the government. But that at least that you're willing to do it if you think you're getting something enough in return. And where the force then gets used is not so much on you as on the free riders. You, Jesse, if you're not complying, or you, Christian, if you're not complying, and then I can comply because I know that the free riders, the shirkers, are going to be punished. But you can't study that finding with taxes. So that really literally did lead me into trying to think about where can I study that that's also has that kind of implications for understanding government and understanding the way in which government operates and is able to get obedience from its people.
So for people who don't...
I looked at military service because I figured there would be material on that. And this creates a different kind of archival problem. It wasn't what I was archiving, it was what had been archived. And it was very hit and miss. I mean, it was much harder than I thought. One of the best compliments I ever got about that piece of research was from Charles Tilley, who said this was really hard-won data. I mean, I really struggled. I mean, let me tell you about some of the problems of getting data for that. You know, occasionally I would be able to find something, but fires were a big problem. There were two different kinds of fires. One was a fire that happened in the United States, for example, which eliminated a whole bunch of records, just burned them down, of people who had served. I mean, the records were gone. They burned up in a fire. Another fire was an arson, which happened in Australia, in the archives in Australia, where a mole from the British government had been put into the Australian archives because the British had all these rules about what could be shared that the Australians did not agree with and violated. So they would share data that the British thought about who had served and when, that the Australians thought was appropriate and the British did not. So the British put a mole in the Australian archives at the National War Memorial to burn down a select set of records that were the British perceived as records they should have control over. So that was one of the kinds of problems with archives. So you'd think you'd gotten something. Another kind of problem with archives I discovered in France. So I went, the French keep very good records. I thought they centralize. All the records that I thought I needed were supposed to be in this one place in Paris. But you can't just get to records. You have to get the person who has the key to the records. And to get to the person who has the key to the records, you have to work your way up the line. I made all the appropriate friendships. I got the person with the key. He said, "You've arrived 3 years too late." All the records were sent back to the provinces. So, you know, I suddenly had a whole new problem that I never resolved. I just decided I didn't need those particular records after all, because it was going to require me going to, 35 different places or something and going through this whole process of getting the key and then hoping the right records were even there. I did get into some records, but I had, you know, a young guy in uniform watching me, bringing me into all these places to get certain kinds of records. And then it turns out that nobody had done any filing. I mean, I was literally looking through boxes and nobody cared what I took out. I mean, I could have stolen all those records. I took photos of lots of things. I had a funny little machine that allowed me to photo things. This was pre-cell phones. You know, they wouldn't let you take a camera in, but I had something they didn't quite recognize as a camera. So I could file, I could put things through it and it would do an OCR kind of thing. I mean, so there were a million different problems with archives that others had kept. British kept pretty good archives, but they didn't give you access. And then they finally told, and I worked it. And they finally told me I could have access. I said, "That's fabulous." They said, "But the way you do it is you have to write to whoever the descendant is of the individual who you want access to." So, you know, I needed thousands of records of people who'd served in the British military. This was well over 50 years after, say, the First World War, and let alone some of the wars of the late 19th century, where there had been conscription. And There was no way I was going to be able to achieve that. There was no NSF grant that could be big enough to try to get access to all of those individuals, right?
So, Margaret, what you hint at this theme that we come across across many of the interviews that we've done with people, and it's this kind of iterative dynamic of the thing you set out to do, and then you're doing archival work, and then you have these problems, and then your project is modified, and then you kind of go from there. For any of the projects that you engaged in, what's the most kind of dramatic perturbance and shift from start to finish that you had as a function of this archival difficulty?
I guess probably the conscription one, which is part of why there's a whole chapter. Why, if you look at the ways in which I've organized the material, you know, I was going to do all of the six, for everything, I was going to do all six of the countries and have equal data on each. And I had to shift that. So I found great data that compared Ontario and Quebec, for example, and allowed me, I think it's one of the best things I've ever written, actually, is that chapter comparing Ontario and Quebec and the different reactions to military service in the two provinces that really had to do with Francophones and Anglophones' attitudes towards the Canadian state. So as a result of not being able to get all the data I wanted, I had to look and see what was promising in data that I could get that would tell a really interesting story that would be the big story I wanted to tell, or would speak to the big story I wanted to tell. And I found really interesting data about conscientious objection, but only for France, Australia, and the U.S. So, you know, I turned that into an opportunity rather than... So going from thinking I would get data on everything when throughout the whole time period, I adapted to how would... You know, these kinds of data exist here, and they speak to a problem that I can theoretically say, with justification, is really a big kind of issue that this data then reveals what the mechanisms are, how what's going on, what the attitudes are, what the variations are. So in all of the cases, there was variation, and I could attribute that variation to something that was incredibly important to my larger story about consent, dissent, and patriotism.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? This book's very close to my heart, and one of the things that I'm interested in is whether it was iterative in terms of the conversation between these new data sources and the theory, which for people who haven't read the book, you draw a really useful set of distinctions between what you call, you know, contingent compliance or contingent consent and opportunistic compliance. Different mechanisms, different pathways. This is all really, really interesting stuff. But I don't know, because you had such a rich background. You weren't like a graduate student going into this with a pre-registered design.
This was my third book.
You had worked a lot of this stuff out in Rule and Revenue. So
professor.
Yeah, exactly. So what was it that you remember about the theory or the mechanisms that you learned from the empirics that you're describing that you can recall actually having like an aha eureka moment during the data collection on soldiering, distinct from the research that you had done before on tax compliance? So that's a very narrow question, but I've been dying to ask it.
Well, you're actually asking two questions. The first one,
at least three, but it's just, I'm not very disciplined here.
So the first one, which is the question of the iteration of the theory and with the facts, is I have an answer to. That's an easy answer, because we wrote analytic narratives to actually talk to that particular problem. So I was at CASBIS as a fellow in 1993-94. I was working on consent, dissent, and patriotism. I was part of a group that had come together that was supposed to be thinking about economic and political development in France and England, but ended up writing analytic narratives. And that was me and Barry Weingast and Bob Bates and Avner Greif and Jean-Laurent Rosenthal. And so we realized early on that we were all using a similar method, and there were others using it. I mean, I would put David Layton in this category, Christian Ure in this category. I mean, there were numbers of us using in some variant of this process of thinking, in our case, thinking in terms of game theory as part of our theory, but, and that's not true of all the other cases I mentioned. But also being affected by what we were learning on the ground and having those two things interact in ways that both changed the theory, but also enabled us to figure out what facts mattered that we had to find that would either disprove our theory or provide some reason to find it more credible. I wouldn't say it proved the theory, but found it, you know, made it seem plausible, more plausible. So it was a way of disciplining our narrative, as we put it in analytic narratives. So I was already deeply involved in that process, and this brought out the process and made it much more apparent to me and to others how we were working, and probably changed the way I wrote, ultimately completed Consent, Dissent, and Patriotism. But within it was always this iterative process. And then you're asking me for something very concrete about an aha moment when, in the process of learning about conscription and military service on the ground, that changed the way I thought about the theory. And I think that aha moment actually came. So one of my processes whenever I'm writing something is to read a lot about the place in the period, not just in the scholarly literature. Sorry, give me a second here. Not just to read the scholarly literature, the histories or the political accounts, or just to look at the records, but also to read the novels of the about the time and the period and the novels that come from that period. To look at the films, documentary and fictional, that are provoked by that period, the poetry, whatever. So it's looking well beyond the sort of scope of the scholarship. It might be stuff I never cite. Anyway, so what that did was make me, as well as reading some of the newspapers and other things that were, you know, of the time, which is part of the scholarly endeavor for sure of what you do. But it made me very aware of the different kinds of social interactions that were going on, which is not something that was I could really do with, say, Of Rule and Revenue. I could do a little bit of that with the last case that I did with the Australian case. But it was really clear in thinking about, say, Ontario and Quebec during this period, very rich novelistic literature, for example, that books you've never heard of, it doesn't matter, but were incredibly interesting about how the Francophones were reacting or how the British, how the Anglophones were reacting in their province. And that made me very aware of the different ways, for example, that the religious figures, I began to look for something I hadn't thought of, was what was being preached on Sundays. It wasn't just what the newspapers were saying. It was what were people hearing in their social networks? What kind of information were they getting? What was the norm that was being evoked? What was being told was the appropriate way to act? And it was very different in Anglophone and Francophone Canada. So the ministers in Anglophone Canada were telling young men it was their duty to go to war, to defend the British, to defend England, to defend the home country from which we emerged, our way of life. The Francophones were being told, you'd be crazy to go out and fight in that war. The French left us here on the ice floes. They've changed the religion. The British were not part of Britain. We're a dominion. We have no obligation to Britain and we have no obligation to France. And we're not being, you know, nobody's invading us. What are we doing? And the Canadian government has not exactly been kind to us. You know, we don't have schools that, as we were promised, that speak. So all the things that I knew were being brought home in those sermons. And in a different way, which made me understand the kind of social networks of information and norm formation that were critical to the story, not something I saw in Of Rule and Revenue, right? As I said, I saw a little bit around some of the tax issues in Australia, but very little because I didn't need it and I wasn't really looking at popular compliance there. Here I was looking at popular compliance. And what was affecting it. So it led me to look for very different things. It was an aha moment and led to these different forms of obligation that, and what creates them, that you picked up as being something incredibly interesting to you, Jesse.
Well, thank you. How did you find the church sermon? I mean, in novels?
Printed. They're printed.
Yeah.
I could find a bunch of them. And often they appeared in the newspapers, depending on the, you know, local newspapers. Just to inquire, doing an awful lot of that awful work that one has to do when you're looking at old newspapers. You know, now it's easier, but then it wasn't. Now it's been digitized much more, but a lot of them were just those machines where you had to.
I love microfiche.
Oh, my God.
And you're fluent in French.
I can read French pretty fluently. I think I report in Consent, Dissent, and Patriotism one of the problems I had with French when I called up one Friday to make an appointment with the colonel and in Paris and was told that he was dead. And when I called back on Monday to try to make an appointment with a different colonel, they said, no, you should speak to the colonel that I thought had died. And I said, oh, okay. And they said, well, he's back from the sea now. He'd been on this mer mort. I'd heard the wrong thing. Over the telephone, different, you know, the French, we are taught that the French all speak one language. They don't speak one language. They have accents like we have accents. And you've learned one and somebody's speaking in a slightly different dialect or different accent, you miss it. So I would not say I was fluent in French.
Margaret, this kind of gestalt approach you had to kind of like immersion into a space to better understand your investigation of it, do you kind of evolve that over your projects? You didn't mention that with regards to kind of the police unions and the dissertation, but over time, do you kind of start doing that and then that becomes like your process?
I'd say there was a bit of a blip with Of Rule and Revenue, because there's only so much immersion you can do because you can't walk, you can't be among them. I mean, I could go to Rome and see the, you know, the monuments, but I couldn't. I lived in Montreal while I was doing some of the research and lived, you know, went to Ontario and all these places. And even though it was years later, there's a sense of the place that you get, and the people are still their descendants of those people, their immediate descendants. I mean, these are their fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers. They're not, they're multiple hundreds or even thousands of years in the past. So it's a very different, and we're still talking the 20th century, right? Whereas in Of Rule and Revenue, I'm talking centuries that for which I can read a lot, but it's, you know, I'm talking 13th, the 14th, the 15th, I'm talking I'm talking BC.
New and so, Old Testament stuff, I believe.
So, you know, there's different kind of immersion you do. And with the longshore workers, I was immersed already in a sense because I was, you know, I held the chair named for their most important leader. So I was going to union meetings and they were my advisory board. And
so last question we usually wrap with is, what do you advise others who engage in data collection efforts? You've now been a senior scholar mentor to dozens of graduate students. We've mentioned John Alquist on this podcast, but there are many others. So what...
You met Emily as we came in.
If you were going to give one piece of advice that you haven't already given on the podcast, there's like any jumping off point you want, what would you like to share on collecting data or archiving it?
Well, I think the biggest piece of advice I give really has to do with the initial choice of a project, whatever methods you're going to use. And then I can tell you advice about using archives or interviews or field work. But, you know, I did not love working on my dissertation. I mean, I'm finding it fascinating that we spent most of our time talking about a piece of work that I did over 50 years ago and which I left behind. I mean, I rediscovered it in a sense in other ways, but I chose it for a whole bunch of very complex reasons that were more intellectual than what I really wanted to study. And it meant that, I've done fine in the world. I'm not complaining, but I did not write a great book out of that. And when I was given the option of turning it into a much more major book for Princeton, who said they were interested in it if I significantly revised it, and Lexington Books, which said they would publish it as was, I said, publish it as is. I'm leaving it. You know, I am not interested in this project. I do not want to work on it anymore. And I loved Of Rule and Revenue, and I loved Consent, Dissent, and Patriotism, and I loved Analytic Narratives, and I loved the work on trust that I did with Russell and Karen and the books that I wrote out of that. And I really loved working on In the Interest of Others with John. It's probably the thing I've loved the most. In part, working with him was such a pleasure. So I really advise students to find a project that they can devote some serious years of their life to and can imagine continuing to work on it even after they think they've finished working on it. And when I got to that point where it was that inflection point for my dissertation, I'm putting that one to rest. And that's the other piece of advice. If you make a mistake, it's not a terrible mistake. Leave it, you know, turn it into something that counts on your CV, but move on. Because if you're going to... You want to invest time in things you really care about and really think you have something interesting to say about it. So that's my big piece of advice. Either find it or move on from it if you haven't found, if you headed down the wrong path for whatever reason. Not the wrong path, but a path that won't lead where you want to go. It's become a dead end. In terms of working with archives, and I think you just have to be prepared for the unexpected. You know, you're going to find things in there you never thought you'd find. You're going to not find things you'd hope to find. You're going to find obstacles you never anticipated, nobody prepared you for. Because often when depending what you're doing in the archival work on, but most of the stuff that I've been working on, it's not like there are lots of people who've mined those archives. It's not like studying the Nazis. You don't know where they are. You don't know what's not there. You don't even know where they are. So, you know, that it's hard to give people advice about that. The other piece of advice I give is anything you do stumble on, make a copy of it if they'll let you. Because you may never find it again. It's hidden. I mean, I found this in archives all over the place, the way they are filed and maintained. You know, there's a lot of material that just gets thrown in boxes. And nobody even knows it's there. It's not well indexed. Sometimes you're lucky and it is. Sometimes even in a well indexed library, there are things that get mixed up and messed up and you want to be able to relocate it.
Margaret, related to this part of what you were saying, I gathered, I gathered that there was you always seem to have a strong theoretical grounding, but that strong theoretical grounding and the big question seemed to help you navigate this. You're never quite sure what you're going to find in the archive. And in a sense, you were able to kind of take whatever you found in the archive and still link it theoretically to where you were going, or you had a facile ability to kind of go, okay, let me draw upon this. I mean, what I find interesting is, like, Jesse and I are even driven to different parts of your research agenda, right? I'm more familiar with the unions and the contention stuff, either the police or the social movements. He's more connected with the patriotism stuff. So I'm just like, it's just like you're read by a variety of different people. But what I find interesting is this thread of the kind of like strong theoretical approach that you've had throughout. But just listening to you right now and knowing the complexity of archives, the ability to kind of still find, okay, this, I didn't find exactly what I was looking for here, but this speaks to this part of the question. That is, it's one of these things like, I find many graduate students don't have that facility. I find they're not interested in that big question. They're not trained in a particular manner. And I'm trying not to make this some generational thing. You know, the older folks were just better trained and they had some better understanding of blah, blah, blah. I'm not trying to do that. But I'm identifying that it becomes, I think, an interesting point that as one engages the archive, which is an unknown of sorts, that the strong grounding in theory helps you do that. I don't think that message is communicated well enough, but I think that came off of what you were saying. And if that's fair, then please. Okay.
Well, it's a combination of theory and having a puzzle. That, you know, that there are lots of different ways in which you can solve most puzzles. Not, you know, not necessarily the New York Times crossword puzzle, but, you know, most puzzles that have to do with human interactions and behavior and the ways in which structures got built, there are multiple threads in, and you can find a pathway to begin to get some sense of it. But yeah, I think the theory, you know, and in my case, often it was some form of game theory that often helped me. I can't say I do game theory. I mean, I don't. But thinking about it as a strategic interaction and who the key players are and, you know, what the possible outcomes could be and why you end up on this path and not that path is, for me, the way I think about these things. And then a lot of different kinds of facts may help you understand, you know, you find that. So the whole idea of analytic narratives is that certain kinds of facts will tell you that you have not identified the right path that people went on, because you wouldn't find those facts on that path. And certain kinds of facts suggest that that path makes sense, that that's the plausible path. So that's back to the iteration, Jesse, because, you know, as you find facts that nothing's fitting, you think, okay, then I have theorized this wrong. That's not the right set of outcomes, or that's not the right set of paths. And you go back to the drawing board, not to make the facts fit the theory or the theory fit the facts, but really that, you know, nothing, it's somehow you just don't have the right conceptualization in mind, and so you got to rethink it. You might have a good puzzle, but you don't have the right conceptualization. So there is that iteration till you get something that is closer, and then, you know, you go back and look for other facts to make sure that you're not just using the facts you'd already found to tell yourself that you're right or wrong, that you haven't just fit it, you haven't done curve fitting.
Hello, thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive and for writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future. Please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.